The discussion about Solomon's request for wisdom. And I tried to point out to you something. I want to come back and clarify just to make sure that, you know, we're all on the same page here. We often say, you know, it was Solomon's request for wisdom. It was just interesting to me that the word wisdom itself was not used by Solomon. He said in verse number 9, Solomon's prayer was, "Give therefore thy servant an understanding heart to judge that I may discern." So you have understanding and discernment were the terms used there. But how did God take that request? Look in verse number 11. God said unto him, "Because thou hast asked this thing and hast not asked for thyself long life, neither hast asked riches, neither hast asked the life of thine enemies, but hast asked for thyself understanding to discern judgment." And those words are used interchangeably. Understanding and judgment they're used interchangeably here. It's translated understanding in one verse and judgment or discernment in the other. Verse 12, God's saying this, "Behold, I have done according to thy words. Lo, I have given thee a wise and an understanding heart, so that there was none like thee before thee, neither shall any arise like unto thee after thee." So these terms here in these few verses, wisdom, discernment, and understanding, in many ways, these are used interchangeably. They are different words, but if we understand that concept, and that is how, you know, the Hebrew communication was, right? Hebrew poetry was a lot of using synonymous terms to say the same thing in a slightly different way. But in many cases, when you go into the book of Proverbs, there will be, you know, wisdom and understanding be used, you know, in the same verse. The first part will use one word for. In many cases, those terms are used interchangeably. They are different words, and it is beneficial to look at the different words and try to get the full scope of meaning. But sometimes it's not actually helpful to, you know, categorize them, you know, as completely separate all the time. There is a lot of overlap. But God is the one that says, "All right, I'm going to give you a wise heart." And we often say, and later on, it's God says of Solomon, "No, he was wiser than anybody that ever lived." And that's where we get the term. It's not, we're not inaccurate in that. But wisdom, understanding, discernment, these terms are all used interchangeably. So wisdom is not simply the ability to win a Jeopardy game show. Okay? It's just simply a fact dump. Okay? Wisdom includes understanding, which is not just having information, but properly using it. Okay? Discernment is taking, you know, the information that you have and applying it to situations and being able to separate truth and error, or being able to separate different facets of what one's being told. Wisdom encompasses all of those things. So wisdom and understanding and discernment, they all work together. They are synonymous, is what I'm saying. They're overlap in their meanings. And so wisdom was not just, okay, you playing the game Stump Solomon is no fun, because it's not just a data dump, but it was right application of knowledge and proper use of that. I mean, you've probably heard this before, but it still illustrates the point well. You know, knowledge is knowing that a tomato is technically a fruit. Wisdom is not putting tomato in your fruit salad. Right? It's the right application of the knowledge. But in the same way, you know, understanding, wisdom, discernment, God told Solomon, in essence, he was going to give him insight, but also he was given kind of an advanced ability to apply what he had. I mean, don't you wish now that you had a better handle on how to apply data correctly than, you know, when you were 20? Okay, now some of you are like, "I'm not quite 20. Okay, well, just take my word for it. I have the same information now, but hopefully I can make a better decision. I can do something better with the information I have now. I look at the same situation when I was, you know, 18, 19, 21, 22, and think, yeah, I could have applied that information better. But God gave Solomon, in his own words in verse 12, a wise and an understanding heart. The rest of the verse, "So that there was none like thee before, neither after thee shall any arise like thee." So God gave Solomon wisdom and understanding and discernment. And, you know, you can insert the other synonyms that we see quite frequently in Proverbs. Okay, God gave Solomon a special ability to understand, to retain, and to properly apply. And then notice what God gave him besides. Verse 13, he said, I've given thee that which thou hast not asked, both riches and honor. You know, that is what we might call grace, right? An unmerited gift, just something extra that God did. He said, I'm going to give you what you didn't ask for, riches and honor, so that there shall not be any among the kings like unto thee all thy days. Now look at the condition in verse 14. If thou wilt walk in my ways to keep my statutes and my commandments as thy father David did walk. Now, just a side note, was David perfect? We know he wasn't. But God said, all right, perfect in the sense of without flaw or without error, no. Okay? But this term, you know, here, when God says, your father David walked in my ways to keep my statutes, we know that David messed up. What distinguished David's response to failure from Saul's response to failure? Yes, repentance. David repented and he returned to the Lord and he accepted the consequences. Saul never wanted to acknowledge that it was his fault, never wanted to accept consequences, kept trying to manipulate his way out of it. I just say that to say, if you think, well, I can't be like fill in the blank, God's standard is not that we never err. I mean, that God's standard is sinlessness, but at the same time, when we do err, for those of you that are perfectionists, you want to wallow in the dirt and bemoan your failure, that's not what God wants. It's to acknowledge it, repent, have a restored relationship, and move forward with the Lord's help and not repeat that again. But here there's a condition given to Solomon. If you will walk in my ways like your father David did, the end of verse 14, then I will lengthen thy days. Verse 15, Solomon awoke, and behold, it was a dream. And he came to Jerusalem and stood before the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord and offered up burnt offerings and peace offerings and made a feast to all his servants. So you have Solomon's request for wisdom here. And then in the next section, we have Solomon's wisdom illustrated. Now, this is a tremendous story. This is referred to often in our culture, and not necessarily by godly people, but you know, in the context of the law or sometimes in politics or whatever. But this story here is quite impressive. Verse 16, now it doesn't start out under great circumstances. There came two women that were harlots unto the king and stood before him. And the one woman said, oh, my Lord, I and this woman dwell in one house, and I was delivered of a child with her in the house. And it came to pass the third day after I was delivered, that this woman was delivered also. Okay, so they were expecting at the same time. Their children were born 3 days apart. And we were together. There was no stranger with us in the house, save we two in the house. And this woman's child died in the night because she overlaid it. And she arose at midnight and took my son from beside me while thine handmaid slept and laid it in her bosom and laid her dead child in my bosom. And when I arose in the morning to give my child suck, behold, it was dead. But when I considered it in the morning, behold, it was not my son, which I did bear. That's very interesting because the children at this stage were what? A week old? You know, maybe at the time of this accident, very, very young. It's interesting to me because I am terrible at the guess whose baby picture this is game, right? I mean, and often when children are first born, you know, they're kind of reddish, you know, and after a couple days, those little things smooth out. And, you know, in some ways, a baby is a baby, but don't you dare tell that to the mother, right? But the mother has stared at the face of her child. And has memorized every feature, has loved it, cared for it, you know. And the mother, even at 3 days old, had already memorized the face and the features of her baby. Okay. Now, that is a skill that I recognize and that I appreciate that I don't have. But you know, she knew that this was her child. Now, this was a tragic accident. It says that the second woman had overlaid it. So I mean, they didn't have this probably. Everything that we have today, whether it's bassinets, cribs, whatever. Basically, she had laid the child beside her and accidentally rolled over on it, suffocated the child in the night. That's a tragic accident. So then she tried to swap babies. And they're arguing, this one, you know, my baby's alive, and you're, you know, they're going back and forth. I mean, how are you going to solve this? This seems like one of those impossible conundrums, right? And what did, I mean, you know what Solomon did. Verse 22, the other woman said, no, the living's my son, the dead is your son. And this one said, no, this is my son. You know, this is an argument right in front of King Solomon. The living's mine. No, the living's mine. You know, you're the one that messed up. No, the dead one's your son. I mean, this is an awkward situation is what I'm trying to say. Okay, this is not a pleasant conversation. This was a very awkward situation. Verse 23, then said the king, the one says, my son's living, your son's dead. The other one says the same thing. Verse 24, the king said, bring me a sword. And they brought a sword before the king. And the king said, divide the living child in two. I don't know about you, but my mind just kind of shuts off right there. I can't picture it at that point. I mean, but I thought, okay, if I could use maybe in some portions of our culture today, this might be considered worse, but for us, I think this might be a slightly better illustration. Let's just say it was a puppy, okay? And who said, all right, that's my puppy. No, that's my puppy. All right, bring me a sword. I'm going to cut the puppy in half, and you can each have half. How would you feel about that? I mean, I can see the looks on your faces right now. I mean, this was far more serious with a human child. And then what was the response of the two ladies? The lady that knew this was her child that was still living said, no, let her have it. I'd rather her have it than the baby die. What'd the other woman say? Nope, kill it, half and half. Well, what did that reveal? Who the real mother was, who loved the child and would rather do what was best for the child at her own sacrifice. Isn't that what mothers do all the time? Yes. And the other one said, nope. She knew her son was dead, so I suffered, you should suffer too. Well, then Solomon says, all right, that's the real mother, give it to her. Would you have thought of that? No. Would I have thought of that? No. That's an illustration of the tremendous wisdom that God had given to Solomon. Verse number 27, the king answered and said, give her the living child and in no wise slay it. She is the mother thereof. Verse 28, all Israel heard of the judgment which the king had judged, and they feared the king, for they saw the wisdom of God was in him to do judgment. Now you see here how this term wisdom is used? It was in right application. You know, understanding how to apply knowledge that you have to the current situation. Okay? Discernment, how do I separate these two? Both of them claiming to be mother. How do I discern this? You know, I wouldn't have thought of this scenario, but when this story gets around, and it would definitely get around, then God was beginning to magnify Solomon. Solomon's reputation begins to grow. Now, we'll come back to the first part of chapter 4 here in a minute, but let's look over at the end of chapter 4. So this is an illustration in the end of chapter 3 of Solomon's wisdom. The end of chapter 4, look at verse 29. God gave Solomon wisdom and understanding exceeding much and largeness of heart, even as the sand that is upon the seashore. I think that largeness of heart, you know, has the idea of the ability to absorb, but also large interests. You want to know everything that Solomon had his hand in? Or if I could say it this way, have you ever had to, whether it was for a job application or maybe it's just for one of these icebreaker things at a fellowship or a party, you know, write down things about yourself. What are your hobbies? I mean, how long would it take to write Solomon's hobbies list? I mean, look at Ecclesiastes chapter 2 and see how long Solomon's hobbies list was. I mean, architecture, agriculture, farming, shepherding, travel, fruits and vegetables and carpentry and music and arts. And I mean, the list just goes on forever, okay? His hobbies, now, I don't know, maybe some of you are like that, but I would venture to say that most of us have a somewhat limited list. You have things that you have to do for work or take care of at the house or whatever, but if you get to choose, you know, you probably have 1, 2, 3, maybe 4 things, but you don't have a list as long as your arm like Solomon did. But Solomon had the time and the money to dabble in all those hobbies, right? Interestingly enough, apparently he decided not to invent golf, even though he's one of the few people that could afford it. Anyway, I digress. But verse 29, God gave him wisdom, understanding, and largeness of heart. Verse 30, Solomon's wisdom excelled all the wisdom of all the children of the east country, and all the wisdom of Egypt. So those were the places that were held in that day as depositories of wisdom and knowledge. There was a large school in Alexandria, Egypt. You know, the Egyptian architects and engineers and all of that built the pyramids and all of those great wonders of the world. And children of the East, that would be Mesopotamia. That would be the area that Job lived in. That would be the area where Abraham was from. But when Daniel and his friends were carried captive, they were trained with the Chaldeans and all the wisdom and learning of the Chaldeans, right? It would have been that same area. But in other words, there were people in both of those areas that were renowned for wisdom. And here the Bible says Solomon's wisdom excelled all of those of the known world. Verse 31, he was wiser than all men, Ethan the Ezrahite, Heman, Chalcol, Darda, the sons of Mahal, and his fame was in all nations round about. And he spake 3,000 proverbs, and his songs were 1,005. Now I know a few of you in here have dabbled with writing poetry or trying to write a song. How long did it take you to write one and be happy with it? Right? Whether it's one poem or one song, and I know Doc Scoville has, you know, helped to put music to a lot of other people's poetry, written some, but you know, ask him. He'll tell you it is a long and arduous process. Some of you may know Dr. David Atkinson. You know, he's written some poetry and he's very good at it. He was down here for a season, and one of the men asked him, how long does it take you to write a poem? And he said, usually weeks. And he said, what's your process? And he said, well, basically there's a lot of balled up paper in the wastebasket. Get started. I don't like it. Start over. You know. But how long does it take you to get one poem ready for publication? And some of you are thinking, I've got them, but nobody else will ever see them. They're not for publication. Right? Solomon wrote 1,005. That's just an illustration of the capacity that God had given him. Verse 33, he spake of trees, from the cedar tree that is in Lebanon to the hyssop that springeth out of the wall. He spake also of beasts, fowl, creeping thing, fishes. And there came of all people to hear the wisdom of Solomon from all kings of the earth, which had heard of his wisdom. And of course, that's mentioned a little bit later on as well. But that's just kind of a summary. His wisdom was illustrated and summarized. But God gave him wisdom. Now, did God exercise wisdom for Solomon? Okay, that's a key point of distinction. God gave him wisdom, but God did not then exercise it for Solomon. Solomon was responsible to use what God had given him. So, if I could say it this way, God had entrusted something to Solomon, and Solomon was supposed to use it. What's a term that we use for that kind of relationship today? God, something has been entrusted to us for our care, and we're to improve it and use it. Stewardship, yeah. I mean, in essence, Solomon then was a steward of the wisdom God had given him. Now, why am I pointing that out? Because Solomon's going to do some very good things. And then about halfway through Solomon's life, God's going to come to him and say, you know, you've done evil in my sight, and I'd get rid of you now, except for the damage it would do to David's reputation. So because of David, I'm going to wait till after your life. But there was a point in time in which Solomon stopped making application, or if I could say it this way, Solomon failed to be a good steward of what God had given him. Okay? Why am I pointing that out? Because I think there's a very practical application for all of us. Okay? God is the one who gives gifts. Right? I mean, the New Testament says that the Holy Spirit divideth to every man severally or individually as he will. And we know there are, you know, ministry gifts, there are spiritual gifts. You know, God has gifted people differently. There are times when God gives gifting, there are times when God gives an area of responsibility. But man still bears a responsibility to make the right choices in that circumstance. Okay? God can install someone as king. The Bible, you know, the Bible's very clear on that. The Lord raises up one, sets down another. God can put you in a position of ministry, responsibility, leadership, whatever, but being in the position is not the end of the road. Okay? There is still a responsibility on our part to steward what God has given us, to use that well, to use the gifts he has given, use the opportunities he has given, to use every aspect of what's been entrusted to us for the glory of God. See, Solomon was given the gift of wisdom, and then there were some very good things, and then there were some very bad things that happened later on down the road. In fact, in the book of Ecclesiastes, we have that long list of all of Solomon's interests. But then he says, I gave my heart to know wisdom and to know folly. And he said, I sought for fulfillment here and here and here and here and here and here and here. That's not a right use of the wisdom God had given him. Okay? He had gotten off track. But God gave Solomon a gift. Solomon was expected to be the steward of that gift and to use it for God's service and for God's glory. All right, now let's go back to the beginning of chapter 4. Solomon builds the temple. Now, that's what I want right there. In the early part of chapter 4, we have a list of his officers and of all of the instructions. But I want you to look here with me at Solomon's grocery list. Can you do that? Drop down with me to verse number 21. And Solomon reigned over all kingdoms from the river unto the land of the Philistines. And under the border of Egypt, and they brought presents and served Solomon all the days of his life. Now, the river there is probably not the Nile because the land of Egypt is mentioned separately. Very often, the river there is the one to the east, which would be the Euphrates. Okay, so this is a very typical style for a Hebrew historian. Their style of writing was very different than what we would do. Very often, they would write a summary, and then they'd go back and give some details to fill in gaps. I mean, a Western mindset, for a historian, we expect them to start at the beginning and tell the story in order as it goes, right? That's what we would expect from a history book. That's a Western mindset. The Hebrew historian, however, is very much an Eastern mindset. It's very picturesque, and they had a different style. So what you have here in 1 Kings chapter 4 is, in some ways, kind of a grand summary of Solomon's life. And then we go back and get some of the events to fill in the gaps. So it wasn't sequential in the sense that he prayed for wisdom, or God appeared to him, he asked for wisdom, God gave him wisdom and riches and honor, and then next week he ruled over from Egypt to the Euphrates. You know, it's not like that, even though that's how we would sometimes think about it. This is kind of more of a summary, and then we go back and fill in the blanks. However, in that context, how many people do you think interacted with Solomon's court every day? A lot. I mean, you remember David had some that ate at his table. Who was the young man that was crippled? And then David said, you can eat at my table? Mephibosheth, right. And David told Solomon in his dying instructions to take care of the house of the man who had succored him along the way. Right? His name escapes me at the moment. Any of you remember it? No, not Jonathan. It was the older man who's just said, Hushai? No, I don't remember. Anyway, we'll find it. But he was told to take care of his family. Let those be of those that eat at the king's table. Well, who would eat at the king's table, or at least on the king's grocery bill? The wife or wives, all the children or grandchildren, the servants. But if somebody showed up, it was maybe a political delegation, and they showed up with a present for the king, would it be like, hey, thanks for your present. You know, there's Wendy's and McDonald's on the way out. We'll see you. It's time to eat. No, I mean, what was the expected course of events? You know, you'll eat with us. In fact, that was part of the host king, I think, you know, showing not only hospitality, but in some cases showing off the power and wealth of their kingdom. Right, but if you dial that out, if I could say it this way, ambassadors or representatives that are designated to the king, if there are all of these countries from Egypt to Iraq and everything in between that are bringing tribute to Solomon on a regular basis, how many people might show up at Solomon's house at any given day? At the height of his kingdom, we're talking about thousands of people, very likely, that would eat there every day. Okay, so in that context, what was Solomon's grocery list? Verse 22, Solomon's provisions for one day was 30 measures of fine flour and 3 score measures of meal. All of you say, Okay, you know, that doesn't mean a whole lot. But this term measure is related to, or maybe it's used in a similar fashion to the term omer in the Pentateuch. But Josephus gives one set of measurements for this. There's other historians that say Josephus's numbers are too high. We should use the lower numbers. All right, I'm going to use the lower numbers just to shoot conservatively. But using the lower set of numbers, a measure is 1.9 bushels. Okay, on the high end, it would be almost double that. It would be 3.7 bushels. You know how much a bushel basket is? Some of you do. If you are a city folks all your life, I feel sorry for you. But Google it, all right? But, you know, a bushel basket, if you get a very large basket of peaches, you know, you might get a bushel basket, but you'd have to have a good bit of money probably to buy that from a roadside stand. Just think about one bushel of flour. Any of you ever, you know, handled a 10-pound sack of flour? Sometimes you buy it that size from the store. 10-pound sack of flour is not going to come anywhere close to filling up that basket. Any of you ever handled a 50-pound sack of flour? I have. You know, maybe some of you have. All right, now we're getting in the neighborhood. Oh, man, they used a 50-pound sack of flour every day. No, no, no. 50-pound sack of flour times 2 times 30. Okay, it was 30 measures or almost 60 bushels of flour. Man, that'll last a month. No, that was every day. That was every day. Now, that was fine flour. Everything that is sold in our grocery stores today as flour would be considered fine flour in Bible times because they had to grind it, sift it. I mean, you're upset if you find anything that's gritty in your bag of flour, right? Well, a lot of times the flour was more the consistency of what we would think of as cornmeal. Or, you know, if you whole wheat flour sometimes is ground a little more coarsely, not quite as fine. But it says here 30 measures of fine flour and 80 measures of meal. So 60 bushels of what we would call flour, and then another 120 bushels of what we would call cornmeal or something similar. Can you wrap your mind around that? Now, even assuming that goes for the biscuits at breakfast and the bread at lunch and the dinner rolls in the evening, that's a lot of bread. I mean, the calculations, again, I'm using someone else's calculations, but just for the sake of illustration, 170 bushels of flour would make 28,000 pounds of bread. Okay? Allotting 2 pounds of bread per person, that would still feed 14,000 people. Now, 2 pounds per day, so I'm saying you break it out, a couple biscuits at breakfast, some bread at lunch, some dinner rolls in the evening, okay? A loaf of bread that you, a regular loaf of bread that you buy from the grocery store, how much is that usually? 20 ounces? So it's a pound and 4 ounces? So that would be more than what we would consider a store-bought loaf of bread per person every day. Obviously, you know, homemade bread tends to be a little heavier and denser and that kind of thing, but still, just think about it in that context. Does that explain why Solomon was drafting all these people to be bakers and confectionaries and cooks? Yeah. So you have all of that, and that's just bread. Now let's look at the meat. 10 fat oxen, 20 oxen out of the pasture. For those of you that have never, you know, had any exposure to that, they were all been grain-fed, okay? But the fat oxen, they'd be put in a stall, and they'd be fed sweet corn or, you know, similar. They're not allowed to walk it off, so they gain weight quickly. It was their COVID-15. But you, generally speaking, what a cow eats for the last, you know, usually 21 to 30 days of their life is what, you know, flavors the meat. So that sweet corn will help the meat to be sweeter when it's butchered out and eaten. Okay, so the fat oxen would be more like that. The ones out of the field would be, you know, just field to butcher to table. All right, and then beside that, 100 sheep, harts, roebucks, fallow deer. Those are three different varieties of deer. Okay, and fatted fowl. Chickens, turkeys, pigeons, doves, whatever. Yes, it was a vegetarian diet. the animals turn the vegetarian stuff into meat, and I eat the meat. That's how that works. Okay. But have you ever just dressed out one cow or seen the end result? People that know that have studied this kind of thing, the oxen, it's in the bovine or in the cow family, but they're usually a little bigger. But let's just, for sake of numbers, say that the oxen dressed out at 600 pounds and the cows dressed out at 400 pounds of, you know, finished meat. And it may or may not, you know, things fluctuate, but just to give us something to go by, all right? 600 pounds dressed out for an ox, 400 pounds dressed out for a cow, a sheep dressed out to 70 pounds. Based on the numbers we're given here, that is 21,000 pounds of meat. Yeah. Barbecue, grilled steak, you know, beef stew, whatever you want, they had it. You ever been to Shady Maple? Yeah. Shady Maple had nothing on Solomon's table. I'm just saying. Now, Shady Maple's the most incredible buffet I've ever seen in my life. Okay. But it held nothing on this. If you have no idea what Shady Maple is, take Golden Corral and upgrade it 25 times with better quality stuff, and that would be Shady Maple. Okay. But I'm just saying, 21,000 pounds, that's 10 tons of meat. Whether it was a day or a month, how do you eat 10 tons of meat in a month? That later on, in other places in Kings and Chronicles, it spelled out he had 12 officers that were responsible to bring a set amount. Well, what I think that was one for each tribe. So in the month of, let's just use our calendar, in the month of January, this tribe was responsible for feeding the king's house. In February, this tribe was responsible for feeding the king's house. In March, so what was that? It was taxes. It was taxes in the form of field crops and you know, food animals, rather than, you know, a cash tax, if you want to say it that way. But the only way that you can come up with that number is if you think about all the ambassadors and all of the entourage, all of the servants that Solomon had, and then 700 wives and 300 cucumber vines, okay, concubines. All right, that in and of itself is 1,000 people, not counting the ladies' servants, not counting their children. Whoa, okay, now I'm understanding. By the time it's the height of Solomon's reign, why you had to feed that many people? Okay, that's just mind blowing. But you know, Solomon was the only person who ever lived who could afford to feed that many people, I guess. But even though he had riches and honor, how did he do it? Taxes. Just a little life lesson for you, that you're probably never going to escape that responsibility until you get to heaven. It is tax season after all, is it not? There are similar accounts in the historians of other places. For example, Alexander found a column that had, you know, inscriptions on it that described the court of Cyrus the king. And Cyrus the king had the daily consumption, according to this list, was 1,000 bushels of wheat of different kinds, 1,000 of barley meal, 400 sheep, 300 lambs, 100 oxen, 30 horses. That's the one that got me. They were eating horse meat on purpose. Okay. Deer, geese, pigeons, other various kinds of birds. But what I'm saying is there are other accounts in history of a king who was over a great empire who had this kind of spread all the time. But when God said to Solomon, you didn't ask for riches and honor, but I'm going to give it to you, this is part of what was involved in all of that. Okay, so you have Solomon's groceries. And then in chapter 5, we have the building of the temple. 1 Kings 5:1, Hiram, king of Tyre, sent his servants unto Solomon. So that's why I say chapter 4 is kind of a summary, all right? And that was a very common pattern for the Jewish historians. They would summarize everything and then go back and start giving specific instances, specific details. And so that's one of the things that makes it more challenging to correctly collate everything in the historical books, because they didn't do it in a sequential order like we would have liked. If you, for instance, you compare that to the book of Acts, you know, how is the history given in the book of Acts? In a more or less sequential order of events, the timeline of how it happened. In the Gospels, it's that way mostly. There's a, you know, there's a little bit of skipping back and forth, but in the Gospels, it's a little more sequential. What I'm saying is that's a Western mindset. That was written to a Greek-speaking world. But here you have, in chapter 4, in essence, a summary of Solomon's reign as king. And then beginning in chapter 5, we start to see, you know, some of the specifics of that. We got like 2 minutes left, so I don't think it's wise to start on this next section at this point. But I just want to leave you with this. Solomon asked for wisdom. God gave him blessings he didn't ask for. Does God do that for you and me? Has God blessed you above what you've asked for? Sure, sure. But when God gave Solomon those blessings, what was Solomon's responsibility? He was to be a steward. He was to use them for God's glory. And he, in some cases he did, in some cases he didn't. But for you and me, while we will never have the wealth of Solomon or the wisdom of Solomon, we do have the blessings of God. And as such, we have a responsibility to steward whatever God has given us for his glory as long as he leaves us here. If God didn't cut Solomon any slack, he said, Solomon, I'm fed up with you. Is he going to cut you and me slack for willful disobedience? I don't think so. So let's try to take that admonition from the life of Solomon, and the next time we're together, we will pick up with the building of the temple. Let's close in a word of prayer. Thank you, Lord.